Vice Chancellor, DVCs, professors, ladies and gentlemen, friends, colleagues, family, nice to have you here, and thank you for coming here to listen to me. I'm going to be talking about penguins and suits, and you'll see I've got a lot of slides. It's my lecture style, and I'll talk a little bit about that just now. But just to give you an idea of where I'm going in the end, there is an end to the presentation, and I'm sure people will start reminding me, there's a clock here, but I'll do a brief, not so brief introduction, then talk a little about information systems, about open source software, about how my research fits into that one, and then where I see things going from there, both for open source, for myself, for the discipline. And unlucky you can't ask any questions, which is not my usual style, I'd love to take any questions afterwards. Now, comment on my lecturing style. When I lecture undergraduates, I normally have one slide for every 4 minutes and I talk around that. But most of you here, the ones I recognize, are way beyond undergraduate level, so I'll see all as postgraduates. And as some of my postgraduates can testify, my lecturing style there is completely different, where I typically have about one slide every 30 seconds. And the idea is for you to develop a gestalt of what's happening rather than an intricate knowledge and a detailed bullet understanding of each note on the thing. So be prepared a bit for those of you who are not my students. After a while, I think you get used to it. So that's just my warning. I want to say some formal thanks to people who've really helped me a lot in my life. Obviously, the list is incomplete. The pictures there are people of who are most special collegial debts to. There's other names there that are various other professional debts too. It was interesting when I made this list that then all of a sudden saw that I've co-authored a paper with each of my colleagues pretty much that's been in the department for the last, for more than 2 years. I didn't know that until I wrote out that list myself. So that was an interesting finding. But I think the most debt in anything in my life I owe to, behind every successful man stands a woman. I've got the luck of having two. And I must thank my mom for the first 20 years of my life and my wife for the last 30 years. My wife is the blushing woman sitting in front of me. Obviously, I owe a lot of debt to my father as well, who passed away a few years ago. And then also very important to realize that research in our discipline is not normally done by one smart mind, but it's actually done by a lot of people, students. I thank all my students, and this is just a list of students that I co-authored with. In publications, there's many more that worked with. But last but not least, I thank you for being here. Not only for being here, because I know a lot of you are just coming here for the wine and eats, but what I really want to thank you for is to make our research possible. I know you often fill in questionnaires, and you wonder where these questionnaires go and whether it's worth effort. I want to tell you on behalf of lots of academics at university and other universities that it is really appreciated that you complete these questionnaires of students. Don't complete questionnaires from companies, but for students, please do. So in choosing a topic, I want to tell you a little bit how I got there, and all academics have got a big ego, and I'm no exception, so I could talk all evening about myself, and some in your lectures seem to be very much like stories about themselves, and I've had the luck of having a fun, exciting life, so I do lots of stuff, and you know, each of these pictures is a whole hour's worth of stories, but there's about 3,000 of those. So if you there's not quite 3,000 yet, but that's my life story in less than a minute. So you can see I'm passionate about running, but anything that's adventure. And luckily my profession as an academic allows me to go to interesting conferences, so I can pursue interesting pursuits. But luckily for you, what 7 years of meditation didn't manage or didn't achieve, the three smaller people, or not smaller people in the front, have achieved. So they managed to reduce my ego to a much smaller size than it used to be. And so I'm not going to be talking about myself anymore, but we'll talk about something more information systems related. And I realize there's a couple of people here that are not quite so familiar with the discipline of information systems. So computer science is a study of information and communication technologies. Information systems is studying the ICTs as they are being embedded in a societal, organizational, personal context. And again, that we can distinguish from bioinformatics, geoinformatics, health informatics, and so on, which focus on a very narrow functional specialization. So the type of things that we do, or the type of technologies, the objects, they can be very technical, like unified communications, cloud computing, service-oriented architectures, mobile internet, which are some of my current topics. But they're not always hardware technologies. Often they are phenomena who are crucially dependent on our ICT, but not necessarily ICT is the focus. You know, things like e-government or mobile government, or even cyberbullying. You know, cyberbullying is impossible without technology. Now, whether IS should study that, or sociology or psychology, you know, there's a lot of interdisciplinary research happening there. Close to my heart, digital divide, ICT for D, M for D, e-learning or technology-based learning. The more traditional fields that Don was talking about of information systems obviously are still part. We look at ICTs in organizations, commercial organizations, and you can see some of the topics that I work on there as well. I'm going to not talk about, because I recognize many faces here, and most of you are familiar with IS. But just to, the two normal units of analysis are either organizations, typically larger ones, or individuals, but we often also study communities or even at the country level when you talk about e-readiness or team. I haven't done any teamwork, but a lot of my colleagues do. And very close to my heart is actually the small organization, not quite the size of a large organization to have the resources. So you have to integrate both corporate decision models or theoretical models and individual decision models, because a lot of the decisions are driven by individuals. So it's a very interesting area. And ICTs, as we all know or should know, are actually not neutral tools. If you look at how your cell phone has changed the way you live, you know that. You know, to give an example, one of my PhD students looked at e-government in Kenya and basically discovered that e-government is no longer a tool there. It's seen as a way by the local governments as a way of, for the national government to exert power and extend its power. And in terms of the World Bank, who forced the Kenya government to engage in e-government, they were actually going further away from their goal, because to citizens, it increases the digital divide, because the haves already have access to government, already have the resources, and they're the ones that have got access to the internet and computers, so they have another channel to reach government. Whereas the have-nots typically didn't have way to reach government. Now they don't. There's an additional channel which is being barred from them. So e-government, despite the intentions, was actually furthering the digital divide. And I'm mentioning that because I'm very passionate about mobile technologies in Africa, hence my work in the Mobile Innovation Lab, as an enabler to increase the quality of life and to reduce that digital divide, which I think traditional ICTs will not do. So choosing a topic amongst all of those is not easy. So what did I do? I looked at my research, and I said, look, what would you guys be interested in? Because in the end, I'm trying to find a topic that makes sense to you. And it's quite hard to do it for such a broad audience. And I thought first, most lectures talk about their PhD work. And my PhD work has got lots of interesting pictures that look like trees and mountains and slides and so on. But I realized that when I delve a little bit deeper in my PhD work, it would turn a lot of you guys off and drive you to the red wine district much faster. So I tried to find something a little bit lighter, and I kept in mind the advice they give to authors of popular science books, where for each formula that they put in a popular science book, it reduces the readership by half. So I've tried to choose a topic that is some that I'm passionate about, that I know a little bit about, that is very entertaining, but it is not sort of switching you guys off. So I think I found it in open source software, or OSS, as I'll talk about. And I think 90% in the audience is familiar with it, but let's just define it anyway. Software that's freely available and allows you to do certain things with a code, often in terms of a certain license. And even though it's got its own trademark, it's most popularly recognized by the icon of the penguin, hence the penguins and suits. Suits represent organizational contexts in which I'm going to research these open source technologies. Okay? But it's not just, the penguin actually stands for the Linux or Linux, whichever you want it, the Linux kernel, the operating system, but there's a lot of other open source software. In fact, my research is more on other applications, you know, like OpenOffice, Firefox, and so on. Very few of you think you're going to be dealing with Linux. Well, within the next year, more than half of you will be running an Android device, so you will have Linux right there. So it actually does affect you all quite directly. A few concepts, if you can, I've got some time. Okay, so when they talk about free software, they actually refer to the spirit, as they say in French, Libre software. So that's why it's often called free Libre open source software. The free as in free speech, as opposed to the free as in no charge, gratuit. And the concept surrounding the openness of the source code of the computer code of that software actually leads itself to an open development model whereby everybody that's interested can help develop the products or the software further. Okay, and so basically it's the analogy gets used there of the bazaar. You have lots of individuals cooperating through some invisible hand and producing something of worthwhile, as opposed to the cathedral approach of proprietary software where they undertake one big project with a team leader that's got a grand vision and basically directs the building of that software project. And a fundamental belief of that is that if the source code is public, then people can quickly spot bugs, so the quality increases but also becomes more secure, because there's more good people in the world, many more good people than bad people, so the white hackers will quickly try and fix all the bugs in the software. Let me skip the licensing story. So there's lots of research happening, and I just came back from an open source conference, which was very interesting. And people do research in the technical aspects or in why people contribute to open source software and so on. And my interest is really in the adoption of open source software in community context, organizational context. So, and we're looking at the factors that drive that. And it's not really a traditional adoption whereby, like e-readers, you know, should I buy one or not? It's more a decision, should I choose between open source versus proprietary? So it's a choice issue rather than a... Now we can go a little bit into generic reasons why people should not opt for open source software. And as you can see, a lot of those actually are both on the why and the why not side. Things like quality, security. You know, some open source software is much more secure than its proprietary counterpart, and some of it is less secure. Some of it is higher quality, some of it is lower quality. And even the cost issue, you know, even though you don't fork out on the initial license, your support and training costs may actually be higher than proprietary software. And it depends on whom you ask. Whether, you know, if you ask Microsoft or Gartner, they may give you a different story than if you ask an open source enthusiast. But I think in reality the answer is both. It depends on the situation. The reason why I'm interested in an open source software is actually not so much of the generic topic, but I believe that open source software has got a big contribution to make to Africa as a continent and to developing countries in general. Okay, BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa now, we hold relatively small numbers of software patents. In fact, software patents you can't get in South Africa and in a number of other countries. So for us, it's actually, we're disadvantaged in terms of the existing body of patents as developing countries. But on the other hand, because open source software allows you to build on those without having to pay royalties, it's a great platform for innovation. So Mark Shuttleworth, the reason why he pushes open source software, he's one of our ex-students, alumni, is because indeed he built his company on open software tools. Okay. If you look at the government alone, the government spends well over 4 billion rand per annum, 4 billion rands per annum on software licenses, and then 3 times that amount to the same companies for support, and all that money flows to overseas companies, the Microsoft, Redmond, and so on. Okay? If you can have open source software, even if it's more expensive, at least that money stays into the country. So that's a macroeconomic benefit which often doesn't get internalized. Okay, building local system development capacity, Brazil's been very good at that in terms of creating local capacity for developers because they've got full access to the code. And in customization to local cultures, languages, OpenOffice is available in the 11 official languages, tied up with Microsoft Office, because you've got the access to the code. So there's strong arguments for using it. Yet in South Africa it doesn't always happen, because we've got a relatively shallow pool of technological skills, and we don't have the economies of scale that India or China have, for instance. Bandwidth is still expensive and slim, although it's changing fast. And there's also some IP issues that I don't want to go into. But so this was a bit of a long introduction to come to my research, which tells a little bit of a story. And when we started out in 2005, obviously not much research had been done yet, and so that it was quite new to South Africa. So we said, let's look at the lay of the land. And we took three students and we each assigned them to a case study, and we tried to find quite diverse case studies of organizations that had adopted open source. Okay, and there the approach was quite exploratory, trying just to find what is happening and to understand the phenomena a little better. So the first case was Novell. Many of you have heard of Novell. If you were around in the 90s, it was a very strong company then, and then they lost their leadership position in the networking operating system. And they were on the verge of dying, and one of their ways they saw to the survival was buying out one of the Linux distribution companies called SUSE. And basically they saw that as one of the saviors as a path. And they had the eating your own dog food philosophy. So they said, if you're going to distribute or promote SUSE as a Linux, as an operating system platform, we must try it ourselves. And the South African division of Novell basically opted to migrate all their computers, bar two or three test computers for compatibility testing, migrated the entire division overnight to Linux from Windows. And they called it an unqualified success. But I don't think they have an option in calling it an unqualified success. It gave some rise to some hilarity in the open source world, because they got, and that's the second mention of the suits and the penguins, basically the penguin rescuing or giving life support to the obese suit business person, basically SUSE rescuing Novell from being broke. Another case, BSA, for those of you who know a little bit in the industry, is quite voracious in pursuing piracy of software. And in 2003, 2004, they sent lots of angry letters or lawyer letters, stern letters to both businesses, small businesses and municipalities. And most people paid up for their unlicensed software. And some, like Mossel Bay and George Municipality, they actually... rather the IT manager the wrong way, and the IT manager said, stop this, I'm just going to go open source all the way. And they were quite successful initially with that. There were some issues, so they did a quiet testing phase, piloting phase, set on the software, installed, they skimped a little bit on user training, so there was some user resistance, especially in the finance department, and they still didn't solve all the issues. It was a success for the IT manager, but when the IT manager left a few years later, they actually did revert back to proprietary software. And the other case, which is quite an innovative case, was Finance High School, who had some prior exposure to Linux, because they had upgraded their server and used Linux instead of Novell, saving a lot of money. And then the next year they got a tax lab installed in the library, thanks to the Shuttleworth Foundation. So in 2004 they had a failure of their intercom and loudspeaker system that most schools have. And they got a quote from the repair people to the amount of 70,000 rand. And one of the teachers said, but hang on, give me half the money, I'll buy some computers, network them myself, install open source software, and for half the price I can not only replace your system, but actually provide a computer in each of our classroom, which I thought was great innovation. So we looked at the common themes, and from that we did a first stab at creating a migration model, a set of guidelines for people, organizations wanting to embark on open source software. And then it starts with getting commitment from top management, product champion, then creating user awareness, doing user, and it doesn't all fit on the same screen, so I split it in two parts. But basically, the research served to develop some guidelines for people. Now that was quite qualitative. We wanted to get a bit more quantitative and get a feel not for what the decision makers were doing, but also how the user experience is for people who actually then get faced with open source software. What is their experience? And it's Kevin here. Kevin Johnson is one of my colleagues who also did a lot of work in that space. So he was a co-author on this one. That was presented at the conference India, hence the ladies there with them. And we went to Ninam Shand Consulting, which is an engineering company. I admit engineers as a special breed of people as well. So they're not maybe your typical desktop users. But basically went in there with a couple of hypotheses, thinking that like cost is definitely a major reason for embarking on open source software, and that users care more about functionality than the technical support. And the interesting thing was that when we sent out the questionnaire, we got an even spread back from open source users and proprietary software users. And we looked a bit close, so we actually found that, hang on, when you look at the census of all the people working at Ninam Shand, 1 in 6 people is only using open source software. So the people who are using open source software are obviously much more committed, and pretty much every open source software user responded to our survey, whereas only 1 in 6 or 7 of the Windows users was actually responding to our survey. And that's a typical example of how you must always take your surveys with a big grain of salt, because your demographics are very skewed, because you've got that response bias of the people who believe in what you're trying to find out about are more likely to respond. So this is a nice way that shows that. In this case, because we had lots of surveys, we could use statistics, so we could actually substitute, and I'll come back to that a bit later on. But yes, in Shand, the cost of the software was a driver. And indeed, we support our second hypothesis. We didn't support the third and the fourth one. The fourth one was the fact that awareness was a barrier. But interesting, it actually was, because people commented afterwards that they didn't know about the open source software alternative. But thanks to the survey, we've now made them aware of this. So just like in any scientific study, you actually do by observing. You're not a neutral observer. You actually influence the reality that you are observing. Okay, and when we do action research, that's obviously explicitly the goal of our research. Let me skip that one. Now, as academics, we don't want to dwell too long in the realm of just surveying and doing stats around these surveys. We want to build some theory. And the first stab at that was by looking at not just the adoption of open source software, but also what makes the sustainability of that adoption viable. And we looked at those factors. And so basically we were looking and trying to extend it from the technical factors, which are fairly well understood by the computer scientists, but looking at the societal organizational factors. And basically went to a number, pretty much every IT consultant that had a lot of experience with open source software, and we had interviews with them, open-ended interviews, and then those of you who are aware with qualitative research, you start doing theme analysis, emerging themes, classifying your themes, linking the themes. And we came up with eventually 4 super themes in which we would classify the themes that we found. But we had a mid-level of themes as well. So like all the financial themes would either have financial themes related to the organization itself, or to staff, or to external financial factors. And the same for the educational themes. Okay, they were grouped again, educational themes relating to the open source software or to the external environment or to the organization. Okay, and the maturity, same thing, the maturity of the organization, of the external suppliers and corporates. And for culture, we also had a couple of, and I'm putting that there because at that time we didn't know where we were going yet. Okay, so what actually often happens with these case studies, and even at conference I was, we still had people reporting on case studies and saying, these are the themes that we uncovered and that's how we organize them. Okay? But you don't want to keep doing that in an academic discipline. You want to come to some consensus on how these themes come back and back again in each case study. So that was the next step of our research. And the physicists and cosmologists amongst us, you know about the theory of everything that everybody aspires to know about. And as soon as the theory of everything doesn't explain something, we just add some more subparticles or some more dimensions to it. Now, in IS, we finally also have our theory of everything. Basically, a way of looking at a technology and how it's adopted in an organization by looking at the technological dimensions, the organizational dimensions, and the environmental dimensions and how they come together. And I must make a brief interlude here, and I'm going to keep doing that in terms of looking, generalizing what I'm doing in OS's research and how it applies to our IS research in general. IS is mature enough that we actually do recognize the important role of theory. And just to get the terminology right, I'm going to be talking about the TOE framework. And with a framework, I look at a systematic way of classifying a whole lot of factors or constructs or variables or concepts or relationships between them. So if you're doing an architectural exercise in an organization, it would be comprehensive, you use a framework. Okay. Now, a theory is almost the opposite. A theory is an abstraction of reality, and it tries to simplify and get the core essential elements out of a certain reality or set of phenomena that you're trying to observe. And basically you develop constructs or variables or concepts, and you look at the relationships, and a lot of that is hypothesized. So basically you say this plays an important role in causing that and that and that, and those are the dependencies and those are the conditions. Okay? And you use these theories to try and explain what is happening in a certain situation. Now, if you're lucky, you can convert a theory into a model. If you can measure your constructs and the phenomena are rich enough or varied enough, and you can get enough observations, you can actually quantify your constructs and your relationships between them, and then basically you can start testing hypotheses around that one. Okay? Unfortunately, IS is a discipline. Because we're linked with so many other disciplines, we've got almost too many theories and models. Okay? We've got well over 150 models that we reference in our literature. So I don't want to spend too much time on those, but for those of you who are not familiar with IS, these are typical names we come across, and they look, the simplest one, and I love it, the technology acceptance model, it only uses basically two determining factors in trying to look at people's intention and eventual actual adoption of a technology. It looks at how easy is the technology to use and how useful will it be to me. Okay? How simple can you get? And obviously, being academics, we try and add more variables and more moderators and more steps and more phases and whatever have you. So the models have been extended substantially, and for good reasons. Theories can look a bit more complex than that one because they often have multiple levels. It can almost be a bit more difficult. You've got to use structured equations modeling or so on to test them. So I don't want to go there. But coming back from that at all, so our TOE framework, basically what we did is we're now 2-3 years down the line. There's already a body of knowledge and literature around that one. So we basically mine the literature and look for models that already exist out there. We try and find places in this more generic framework that we're trying to develop. So like there's an OS maturity model, which obviously plugs into our technological criteria that we need to look at. And to give you a feel, I'm not going to discuss each of those because otherwise the wine will go cold. But to give you a feel for the type of dimensions we're looking at, and the technology, we look at the maturity of either open source software in general or that particular product that you're trying to adopt. The readiness, the compatibility with existing systems, very important, for instance, if you want to interface with Microsoft Office. The perceived complexity and the actual complexity, the various cost and benefit relationships where you can try it out, observability, and so on. And each of those little rectangles can be broken down into a lot more detail as well, which I will not subject you to. So this breaking down the costs in various models as well. Organizational factor is similar. We can break it down, decompose it in lots of contributing factors and plug in certain models there. And we did the same for the environmental factors. But basically you can see how we built up a more generic, a consistent, and quite a complete way of looking at all the factors that could be involved with it. And having constructed that, we again went to our post-suffering IT consultants that work in the space of open source software, and we tried to validate that against them. And some of the factors we could say were favored. Some of them were inhibitors, hygiene factors. Some of them were promoting open source software. Some of them did both. Some of them were not found in the literature before explicitly as part of theoretical constructs. And so once we have this initial validation, we obviously need to validate it more concretely. To give you one example of how that can be done is a paper presented just recently, is applying it to a case study that was done before without the framework. Mark read that case before, and basically what we did is we looked at the factors or the data Vic had, and I reinterpreted that using that framework. Okay, and it's a quite interesting case study because it's just down the road from us, Metropolitan Health Live. They wanted to upgrade their PBX system, their call center, and basically they asked all the proprietary vendors to quote, and they had a fixed delivery schedule, and they had to do some customization. And the three vendors that were invited to quote threw up their hands and said, it's impossible for us to deliver to your specs in that time. And then somebody in the organization who'd worked with open source before had been playing around a bit, and he sort of downloaded Asterisk, played a bit with it, did a proof of concept with management, and basically, to cut a long story short, they implemented Asterisk with great success in that organization. The call center for a medical aid administrator is a core functionality. It's not strategic advantage, but it's a critical business process. So if the call center goes down, it's bad. So it was quite a good case showing for an open source. And the TOE framework was basically able to reclassify all the factors that we found. Again, you could look through those. Some of them may make sense, some of them not. Like, interesting, Metropolitan, they didn't care about a couple of million rand or tens of millions of rands to make sure that systems were in place. Okay, so the cost was not the driving factor for the implementation. The fact that they did save a lot of money, by a rough estimate, 30 million rand per year over 3 years, was an added bonus, but it was not the driver for doing that. Okay, the key driver there was that they were able to customize the software to their needs and implement it in a very short time. Another factor that they often want with open source software is that they actually want to have the commitment of a large player that actually can fix things if necessary, can provide the support. Again, there, they didn't find the support in the country. They trained some people who had already knowledge with open source software, and they trained them in the source code and basically developed their own in-house support for that. Okay, but important was that they had the slack to create these resources for themselves. An interesting thing after that success, the next thing they did is saying, well, let's look at Microsoft Office. Is there a real need for us to actually pay licenses for Microsoft Office? Okay, I'm not going to tell you what happened afterwards because I don't know. Okay. Now, my passion doesn't lie necessarily with a large organization because they're rich enough to do their own research. In fact, they've got research organizations like Gartner and so on who can do research for them. My passion lies with the small organizations, which I think need the assistance of the academic community more than we do. So we looked at SMEs and we looked at what they were doing. And I'm not going to bore you because I can see the time is running a bit fast. But basically, the TOE framework was quite useful in unearthing the issues that SMEs experience. And to a large extent, some of the issues are the same, but some are also different. They don't have the slack, they don't have financial resources, but they also don't have the slack human resources. So the one balances out the other. They want to save on license costs, but they can't provide the internal support, and they don't have the time to play around with it. They don't have the technical know-how to master what is required to implement the resources. So it is a bit of a win-loss situation in terms of, and I was hoping to find a validation here that SMEs are a viable market for open source. Okay, but sometimes what you hope for doesn't happen, and in this case it didn't. I find actually one of the biggest barriers, and I'll come back to that later on, is the fact that they're either not aware or they don't have access to resources that help them with us. And that refers to the IBM Faculty Award, where my research is now on actually trying to build a portal with information, objective information, not vendor biased, where they can go for help, determine where they are in the level of the maturity of ICT in general adoption, and find assistance and appropriate resources and plans for going forward. And to have that loose from any vendor information, I think, is a really important thing. So that's one of my passions. Okay. And along with SMEs, for-profit organizations, we also have NGOs. Okay, we've got well over 100,000 NGOs in South Africa, which is one per 40 people almost, which is a uniquely African phenomenon. They have NGOs in the rest of the world, but not to the same degree. Okay. And that was in a conference in Nepal. Okay, and to me, NGOs again seem the prime candidate for the adoption of open source software. Okay, their functional requirements are often a bit simpler, not always, but some because they don't have to compete head on with the other commercial competitor. They tend to operate in very tight financial resources, especially in Africa, and their philosophy of developing the country or a certain cause can be seen much more aligned with the open source spirit and development model. So to me that was a true test of, is open source software actually being implemented? And luckily we had something to base our research on, which is a study done by in South Africa, on the state of ICTs in South Africa. And if you look there, only 1% of the NGOs uses Linux, and very few use applications that are open source. So that was a bit of an eye-opener. Now, again, we don't know how representative that is. A year later, we did a very completely randomized proper sampling approach. We took every 50th or 20th NGO listed on the PROTHER database and sent out questionnaires. The picture was slightly better. We found almost 20% of the NGOs using open source software, but most of it was in the web browser, email, document management sphere, not so much in the operating sphere, which, okay. But interesting, already 10% is moving into the cloud, which is something I could again talk for another hour on if you wanted me to. Okay. Looking at the barriers, it was a survey, so we could test some hypotheses, and we thought that the technology barrier would be the greatest. Okay? It turns out that the technology barrier was indeed extremely great, but also very interesting is the awareness barrier, the knowledge barrier is extremely great, and was even more so for rural SMEs, and we assume it's going to be even more so for NGOs that are further removed from internet resources. So again, that motivates my quest for actually trying to bring more ICT relevant and quality ICT decision making information to SMEs and NGOs, small organizations. Another interesting observation was that do as I say and not as I do, and I'm a little bit guilty as well. I'm using Impress or OpenOffice to run my presentation, but I don't always run my lectures on OpenOffice, so but this time I do. But so the same is true in the NGOs, although a lot of them subscribe or ascribe to the principles of open source. A lot fewer of them are doing it for practical reasons, are not using open source even though they wanted to or they say they would like to. This is a different representation of the TOE model, radar model, that quickly shows you what factors in the technology, the green ones are the technology factors, and under the importance, again, remember that TAM model, ease of use and usability, okay? But affordability is a great driver here as well, and the ability to customize to their own processes, okay? Whereas under the environmental variables, the biggest one there is actually the appeal of open source, the philosophy, which I like very much. Skills is again a critical resource for, or the biggest factor for the NGOs. So to complete the circle, let's look back at the individuals, the end users, how are they? And we did a quickie on UCT students, and basically we tried to distinguish between, is there a difference between normal users and high-powered users like my son or other geeks, okay? And how do you tell whether somebody is a power user of technology? Well, we actually had two categories. We had normal power users, meaning technical literate, but they're the ones that if you plug in a cable on a LCD projector and it doesn't work, they can make it work. That's a power user. Now, a high-power user is somebody who understands the XKCD jokes. Okay, so those of you who haven't been to XKCD yet, okay, you've missed a major part in your life, and if there's one thing you take away from this lecture, okay, go to XKCD and see what you can stand. Okay. Sudo is basically, in Linux, is a way to acquire superuser rights for one limited time, so you can actually, you can have the maximum rights possible, so you act as a godlike figure. Okay, in my household, sudo never works. So I've tried it many times, but the coffee never comes. don't want to spend too much, but you see, the one fun thing was that the super users, the high super users, are actually have got that philosophical commitment. They like using open source technology because of the underlying philosophy. Otherwise, the fact is, I can talk a bit through that as well, but I think okay, let's look at the future. I want to spend some more time on the future. Where's open source going? And like a lot of people in 2000, we were, I think you should be a little bit committed to your cause, and we thought, well, now's the time to sell the shares in Microsoft, because in 10 years' time, Microsoft will hardly exist, just like Novell. Linux will rule the roost on the desktop. Now what's happened is we were half right. Okay, it was a good time to sell your Microsoft shares because they were worth twice then than they were worth now. So, but we were not right in terms of the prediction that most desktops would run in the Linux. Okay, but maybe it doesn't matter because, like I said, if you're going to look at Africa, 90% of the computing devices in Africa will run Linux, but in the form of Android, because 90% of the computing power in Africa will be probably a combination of mobile technologies and cloud technologies. Okay? And cloud technologies, again, they also run on open source, because if you run in the cloud, you want to be able to scale. If you want to scale, you don't want to worry about how many licenses have I got. Okay? So to me, those are the two trends. So maybe we may have lost the battle on the desktop, but maybe we're still winning the war. Okay. Now, open source is just an underlying or one symptom of a larger trend that I hope seems to be happening. And that's the open trend, whatever I can call it. Okay, the trend towards more open content. Okay, and 5 years ago I told my students, you can't quote Wikipedia in an academic article. And now I'm telling my students, before you do anything, go to Wikipedia. Okay, so I've also had to change. Okay, the dream is to have a world where every human can access information, anything that's ever been taught before. Okay, and I think we're getting there. Okay, and it's a wonderful dream to have, and technology is making it possible. Wikipedia, Wikimedia, Wikibox. Academia is a bit slower to follow into that one. Okay, there's a whole industry built on academic journals and publishing and so around that one, so we're a bit slower in that. We have got a movement called Open Access Journals, where you publish and anybody can read articles, and I'm hoping it's growing. There's a little bit in tension with the Department of Education, which still rates the classic paradigm higher. Luckily, UCT, I think, is very far in its vision ahead of that one, and it's just not telling its academics you can only publish in the E-rated journals. So I think UCT is leading the pack there. In fact, UCT, I don't think I've told anyone that. I think UCT, as far as I know, is the only university and the first university in the world that has got open source software as a default paradigm in its intellectual property rights. So I think the department should look that up and to see if we're indeed the first university in the world to make that a default. So again, I want to applaud UCT in that one. It's fun to work for a place like this. I'm not just saying that because my boss is sitting there. okay, the other trend which I think should become more pronounced is that one of open data. If you publish an article, you should release the data set as well. It's happening in economics often, but not in the other sciences enough, so that other people can check, can build up meta-analyses on the basis of other data as well. And so to me, that's a matter of integrity. I believe in open access journals because my most cited journal article was actually published in an open access journal. So to me, it's a great way forward. It was also the only article where I got feedback from community people, non-academics, which was great. A special exponent of open content is that of open educational resources. You may have heard of the poster boy of this, which is MIT OpenCourseWare. I believe very strongly that OpenCourseWare has got a very big role to play again in Africa, because in Africa textbooks are expensive and affordable by most students in, I'm not talking about South Africa, I'm talking Africa as a whole, and a lot of teachers are lacking in the ability to develop quality resources. So there is an OER Africa website, but it's not, in fact, even as good as, again, where UCT is taking a leading role on the continent in terms of what it's doing in terms of open content, and please go there. I started getting involved very early on with open content, even before it was called open content, and I keep trying to contribute textbooks. If you want to go on a very fast training course on learning about social media, go to the open content portal and follow the links to the Internet Superuser textbook. Okay, my name is Dee, but I actually didn't develop it. It was developed with a partner organization with UCT, an online company. I'm working on making all my courseware available also as open educational resources. But the one little nagging thing is that you can make all of this and invest money in making it available so you can build it, but will they come if you build it? Okay, so we explore that as well, and don't worry, this is my last little study, Tunisia. Okay, and I presented it last week. The paper, we sampled academics in West, East, and Southern Africa, and we asked them, do you use open education resources, and if not, why not? Okay, and many of them use it to a limited extent, not as much as we would hope to, and again, there's a strong sampling bias, so I think on the whole, you can say open education resources are not yet used much. And we tested the model as well, and the model came back to the old TAM model where, you know, the usability and the expected usefulness is actually the major drivers of this open education resource. But lower down the survey, we also looked at the real barriers and technology issues. As you know, in Africa, even just getting the survey out and back from them was a major challenge. But discovering open education resources and determining how relevant they are to their situation and how good they are, and their personal constraints in terms of personal computing resource and time, was also a major issue. Interesting enough, nobody seemed to have issues with the cultural bias built into a lot of Western education resources. I'm not quite sure whether that's really true or whether it was just another wave on that big ocean of the open floods, is that one of open design and open hardware. You can build processes using open designs. You've heard of the three-dimensional printing, or what you're going to print. Okay, there's a Thingiverse website that has got open designs, which give you products that you can design, and you can print anything from gun parts to flower parts. Okay, and that was very frightening to me, so I did a quick Google search. And luckily there are much more hits on flowers, the 3D printing of flowers, than 3D guns, so I still believe in humanity. A little offspring there, you know, if you, somebody even starts a project in trying to have an open technology platform, blueprints for all the industrial machines that they identified as being critical to civilization. So if all of a sudden Iran and Iraq and Israel and so on start doing bad things, okay? Just make sure you've got the internet connection and download that stuff, rig up a fab lab, and off you go. That's my vision on open source. Okay, where do we go as a discipline in IS? In terms of technologies, I'm a firm believer. This is what I'm researching at the moment. This is, I believe, where we're going in Africa, where the opportunities lie, both for competitive advantage for small organizations, but also as a discipline. Let me skip this a little bit because I'm running out of time. The one methodological problem we have in our discipline, I believe, is that we're very good at analyzing individual case studies and understanding what's going on. And we also have got a good grip on having theories that explain fairly simple phenomena in large bodies of agents, okay, like technology acceptance. But we're not good at finding very complex phenomena that play in large and heterogeneous sections of agents and understanding what is happening there. And to me, that needs a set of methodologies that allows you to do case-based reasoning, to build models that are applicable in one context and another context, and you need to have like 10 or 15 different models that apply in different situations. And our statistical tools, but those statistical tools require large numbers of observations, which we don't often have. So, and that's, I think, where the discipline is going in terms of methodology. Now, the most interesting thing for me is that in IS, 20 years ago, like the Dean Van Ross said earlier on, we started out being not quite a slave to the commercial business, the large organizations. I think that's where where we should be playing in that role, so that we try to figure out how ITs and ICTs can become more efficient, can drive companies to become more competitive. And now we're reflecting more on how can ICTs make this world a better place? How can they improve the quality of lives of people in Africa? Okay. And we're also starting to reflect on the foundations. How do we know what we know? How do we know what we don't know? And so on. So that's the philosophy underlying our artifacts is an important one. In terms of personal space, I'm not going to talk to all of those because I believe what's happening in the discipline I should be following. But my two big projects at the moment, like I said, is open resourcing my course materials, and also I'm very passionate about building this information portal, which I got to money for from IBM 2-3 years ago, and finally this year after I didn't have to be HOV anymore. I could get some students to work on it, and hopefully that's going live either end of this year or beginning next year. Thank you very much. It's been, I think, a bit of... Now you're ready for my next set of lectures. I think now you understand my way of presenting. But thank you for your attention. Please do keep completing those questionnaires that we keep sending you, not just us, other people as well, other researchers, because they are really valuable. There should be plenty of eating drinks outside. I thank you for your attention. I hope you come to more of these inaugural lectures, because it's nice for us, it challenges us as well to rethink what we're doing in our research. And if you've got any contributions to make, please email me. It's quite easy to Google me, just Google my name, and there's only one of me in the world, so you will find my email address quite quickly. So thank you again. And well done.
Thank you, Professor Jean-Paul Pommel. I'm going to have to read some of the studies themselves, because as you were describing the research, I kept thinking of myself as one of those subjects, trying to figure out why I'm struggling so much to move over to a whole lot of open source software. And I wonder whether... And this is, as you correctly said, we don't allow questions and answers at an inaugural lecture, so we have to tackle the speaker over drinks and snacks. But I wonder whether there are also avenues of research that are not just trying to identify barriers, explain uptake and people's and organizations and NGOs' responses, but a whole batch of maybe randomized controlled trial experiments that intervene and can help us understand what can change our behavior, not just why we behave the way we do. And I would certainly be interested to be a subject in that, because I feel I need to push. It's my pleasure to invite Professor Brown to the stage, to the podium, to deliver the vote of thanks.
Okay, well, thanks to JP for that very insightful lecture on the entitled Penguins in Suits, Perspectives on Open Source Software from a Discipline in Flux. So JP explained, I think, throughout the presentation why he chose that title, but I found it very interesting that in the title he had made mention of suits. Now, as you've seen from the presentation, and those of us that know JP, we don't often associate him with suits, more often with sports shorts and climbing boots. And in terms of standing on the shoulders of giants, okay, I think, I suppose we could have an argument about it in the department, but certainly I believe that JP is one of the giants in the department. Okay, I think since the retirement of two of our professors, Professor Mike Hart and Derek Smith, I think JP is now the longest serving member of staff in the IS department. He certainly was here before I joined. I joined about 3 years after that. And the high level of research productivity that has been mentioned, I think more than 133 research articles published, I think that has catalyzed many new staff members when they join to try and achieve that same level of output. And I think most of us have tried but have not managed to ever reach the level of productivity that JP has set. And so that certainly is a precedent that he has set in the department. Concerning the IS field, as JP has pointed out, okay, we are interested in phenomena such as what he has presented that are at the intersection of technology issues, organizational, individual, society, and environmental concerns rather than technology per se, and hence such studies as that on technology adoption. In terms of the discipline being in flux, I think you can also understand why it is in flux. The phenomena we investigate are continually in flux. There's constant changes and advances in technology, as we all know, and these impact on us as individuals, on organizations and society. In turn, individuals, organizations and society interact with the technology, adopt it, appropriate it in various ways and in some ways that the designers themselves have not thought about. So there's often both designed and emergent consequences of technology use, and hence the continuous flux that the discipline is in. And I think it's worthwhile to mention, therefore, that in information systems, we need to also, I think, go back to our foundations in terms of drawing from systems ideas concerning how to look at this flux. Complex adaptive systems theory and so on are useful lenses, and certainly not to become too enamored with technology, but also remember that our discipline is information systems. So the phenomenon of OSS adoption that JP has presented illustrates this in terms of looking at technological, organizational, environmental issues that affect its adoption. It seems it makes rational economic sense for organizations, especially in developing countries, for SMEs, for NGOs to adopt OSS, but we very often find, and as JP's research has found, there's this persistence with expensive, sometimes proprietary solutions. And so therefore, I think JP's research is very useful. It's in IS, okay, we judge the value of research in terms of its relevance to society, to organizations, to individuals, and its persistence. Okay, there is a problem, a persisting problem concerning the adoption or non-adoption of technologies. And so this area is persistent, it is relevant, especially in the developing country context, to economic development, to social development. And so this research is very useful. It sheds light on these issues and hence provides a basis for more informed practice. So I think in conclusion, therefore, I'd like to thank JP for his contribution to the discipline of information systems, to what he's done, the contribution he's made to the Department of Information Systems here at UCT, to the Faculty of Commerce and the UCT at large. Specifically to his wife and family for his support. It's clear that, okay, they do give him support. They give him the freedom, as you've seen, to travel, to present at so many conferences. I think more than 83 conference papers published to date. That, of course, requires family support. I think they don't restrict him in that sense. And finally, okay, for UCT and the support staff that have made this occasion possible, okay, to showcase this research in information systems, and to UCT for allowing us as academics to have the autonomy to conduct the research that we value and we think is important. And finally, we'd like to thank all of you for your attendance today, and we invite you therefore after this to join us for further discussion, I suppose. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings the evening, this part, the formal part of the evening, to a close. I would just ask you to allow the platform party to leave, and then please join us upstairs where we have wine and refreshments, and where you can convey your congratulations in person. to our guest speaker this evening. Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.